I'm Anne Strange Amps, and have you ever had something happen to you that is so embarrassing you wish you could forget it?
I'm 10 years old, and it's Girl Scout Awards night. And at the awards ceremony, my name is called, and I'm walking up the center aisle, and I felt my underwear slide down my skinny little legs and puddle on the floor. And I squatted down, picked them up, shoved them in my pocket, and continued marching to the front of the room. Whereas it turns out, my mother was one of the scout leaders handing out the awards.
So a couple years ago, I was working as a lifeguard, and I worked 5 minutes away from where I lived. And I was leaving my job. I was done for the day. On the way home, I was rear-ended, and the paramedics thought it would be good if I went to the hospital. So I was strapped into a backboard and rode in an ambulance to the hospital. By this point, I really had to pee, and so I had a nurse come in and help me get into the bedpan because I was still, strapped down. And I peed so much that I overflowed the bedpan, and it was really embarrassing because I was just the girl covered in pee.
In the seventh grade, they sent, all of the good kids on this, day trip to a Christian camp. And so we get there, and they put us on, this series of trust-building exercises. And we get to this 12-foot wall, and we're given this scenario of you are being hunted. Get over the wall. And my crush is up there, and he's watching me, and I'm like, okay, I can do this. And so they hoist me up. I latch on to the wall, and I know immediately this is a mistake. There's no way in hell that I'm going to be able to pull myself up. And so I'm hanging on this wall, and a friend of mine is up there, and she has the bright idea of trying to grab my belt loop of my pants to pull me up. But what she does is she grabs my sweatshirt, undershirt and all, and pulls it up over my head. And so I'm essentially naked from belly button up, attached to this wall with crush above and a whole team of people below seeing everything that's going on. And I'm just hanging there like, this could not get any worse.
Okay, we've all had humiliating moments. But today, oh yes, they can be a lot worse. Because social media. I mean, just imagine if your dearest frenemy posted a picture of you covered in pee or hanging half-naked off a wall on Facebook or Instagram or some other site where it will live forever. Today, unto the best of our knowledge, the internet remembers everything, but shouldn't some things be forgotten? Well, that's a question that has been occupying Georgetown University's Meg Jones. She studies law and technology, and she thinks we have a legal right to be forgotten because embarrassing or revealing personal details can really hurt us personally and also professionally.
We see this time and time again in employment settings where something that even things that seem innocuous or not that harmful are considered to be poorly reflective on the company or the institution, and an individual gets fired for it. But there's a lot of other things. You know, whether if you search somebody on Google after you see what their Google results are, do you want to go on a first date with them?
Will you also document some cases where the fact that the internet never forgets anything winds up victimizing people who are already victims? You know, for example, a rape victim who has struggled and struggled to move past this, and yet maybe 20 years later, if somebody Googles her name, the articles about her rape may be the first thing that come up. So maybe the first thing that her employers or her potential dates learn about her. Are there other examples like that that come to your mind?
One of the other things that we talk about in the book is when somebody decides to change their gender. And that can be really challenging for particularly American kids who by 2 years old, 92% of American kids have an online presence. So if at some point through adolescence or adulthood they decide to change their gender, that is a lot of material to combat, and to re-identify as a different gender can be really challenging.
Well, and we haven't even talked about cases where somebody with malicious intent might post something about you that they've dug up possibly from their own history with you. I'm thinking about this relatively new thing, revenge porn.
Yeah, revenge porn is a category, I guess, of information that resides on sites specifically for humiliating your ex in a way that exposes them through some sexual content. So for the most part, what we see are videos and photographs of women passed out and somewhat naked. And this is obviously malicious, but it's also really challenging to get down.
We're kind of circling around the question of, are you allowed to be forgotten? Like, if you want to be forgotten, should that be a basic human right?
So it is a basic human right in Europe, and it has gotten some traction around the world. There's a case happening in India right now. Japan, Russia have all acknowledged a right to be forgotten as a fundamental right within their privacy rights. In the United States, I don't think we're ready to answer that question yet. We're sort of at this moment that I think is so exciting, where we're having to ask ourselves which American ideology we want to foster. We have this long history of second chances and reinvention, and you can be anything here. And then we also have this right to know.
Well, but you could easily talk about, say, kids. Anybody who's had a teenager or an elementary school kid knows that they take stupid, stupid pictures of themselves doing things that will get them in trouble. And then they leave that stuff up on their Facebook pages. And, you know, every time one of those kids applies to college, their parents say, have you cleaned up your Facebook page? But still, that stuff's out there. And shouldn't kids be allowed to grow up?
Yeah. And a lot of this is also about remembering that, for the most part, the really bad horror stories that we hear about people online is just bad luck, that it could really happen to anyone. A lot of times when we look into the details of things, it's somebody accidentally pushed the wrong button, somebody's phone got stolen. There's a lot of ways that information leaks.
Have you taken steps yourself to try to limit the amount of digital information that exists about you?
I have. I don't have a Facebook page. I think not having one limits the amount of information about me online. You know, I use encrypted apps on my phone. It's not easy to encrypt everything that you do on your phone. You know, I put the little piece of tape over my camera on my desktop, which you should too.
Wait, I don't know about that. I'm supposed to put a piece of tape over the my engineer is nodding at me like, yes, dummy.
Yeah.
Wait, that camera can just come on and take pictures of me when I don't know?
Yeah, there's a whole underbelly of people, of hackers, who hack women's webcams and trade access to their webcams. They call the individuals, the women that they're spying on through their webcams, their slaves. But yeah, your webcam is so easy to hack. If someone's in your computer, it's really easy for that to be on and for you to not know it. And so it's just best to cover it up with a piece of duct tape.
Sort of like not undressing with the windows with the shades up.
Well, and what's amazing about this group of individuals is that they're not even necessarily looking for anything sexual or intimate. They just love the power of watching someone do these tedious tasks on their computer without the individuals knowing.
That's classic voyeur.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know, listening to you partly makes me never want to go near my computer again. Except that's impossible. You know, it's a different, when I talk to somebody like you, I just suddenly realize that I tend to think of my gadgets, you know, my phone, my computer, as under my control, And I think of it as a one-way thing, right? So that anything I enter, I'm entering and I'm putting in there. It just doesn't occur to me to think of it as a two-way mirror.
You should think of it as a million-way mirror. There are so many access points to your device. So you have one, but all of your apps have another, and they share information with the cloud, and the cloud shares information amongst other cloud servers. It's really a way, an extension of you into this entity that has millions of nodes and access points. So while you have one interface, there are lots and lots of entities that have other interfaces into your information.
Meg Jones is a law and technology professor at Georgetown University, and she's the author of Control Plus Z, The Right to Be Forgotten. So if you think the internet has a long memory, consider how long a country's memories can last. And take a national trauma like 9/11 or Gettysburg. The collective memory can haunt generations. National memories can also spark cycles of violence. Think of how the Serbs targeted Bosnian Muslims in the 1990s. So, a common response to genocide is the vow to remember, right? Never forget. But journalist David Reif has come to believe the opposite, that sometimes the best way to deal with historical trauma is to forget. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Reif to talk about his new book, In Praise of Forgetting.
David, there's a famous line from George Santayana that we hear over and over. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Do you think he was wrong?
Well, I've written a whole book on the premise that he's wrong, so I hope he's wrong. Look, I think that is the dumbest thing, to be candid, ever said by an extremely intelligent person, and Santayana was a brilliant, brilliant man. First of all, there's absolutely no empirical basis for such a claim. It is, to put it charitably, wishful thinking. The murder of European Jewry and of much of the Roma population of Europe by the Germans in the 1940s did not stop what happened in East Pakistan and what became Bangladesh in 71, didn't stop what happened in Cambodia, didn't stop the Rwandan genocide, et cetera, et cetera. So already you're on pretty shaky ground just to claim that we learn things from the past. And nobody in Rwanda, I was actually a correspondent in Rwanda in 94, nobody in Rwanda said, oh, well, oops, the Germans did that terrible thing, so we won't do the terrible thing we have in mind.
So the whole idea of, I mean, the mantra that's repeated about genocide is never again. And you're saying people don't think about preventing genocide as a principle. It's, you've got to look at it country by country, sort of the specific circumstances.
Well, first of all, mass murder historically, alas, almost always is the product of fear. Fear of the other, fear of a population seen as somehow being existentially dangerous. The Germans, for example, the Nazis, referred to the Jews as a bacillus, in other words, as a kind of plague. If you're afraid you're going to be infected by the plague, you try to stamp it out. I once wrote rather bitterly in a book I did many, many years ago about the Bosnian War that actually the phrase never again, you know, if it could be taken seriously at all, simply meant never again would Germans kill Jews in Europe in the 1940s.
And you were a reporter during that war in the 1990s. And I'm guessing that your experience there had a lot to do with writing this book. I mean, sort of this whole question of how memory can actually be used to lead to war rather than peace.
Well, this is the other side of what I'm trying to address and trying to argue exactly. I was a correspondent in Bosnia. I was again in Kosovo, although that was for a much smaller amount of time. I was in Sarajevo during much of the siege between 92 and 95. And I saw the ways in which memory can be not a goad to forgiveness or reconciliation, which is the kind of official view, the view of the mainstream human rights community of the UN, frankly, of most decent people. Memory was completely instrumentalized in the Balkan Wars. I tell a story in the book of being in Belgrade, Serbian capital, in 1993, interviewing a nationalist politician, another extreme guy. And when I was leaving the interview, which gone perfectly well, one of his aides gave me a folded up piece of paper. When I opened it, said 1453, which, you know, is the date that Constantinople fell to the Turks. You know, the message was clear. The message was, we Serbs are resisting a new Turkic, Ottoman, whatever, Seljuk onslaught. And we are...
And they're calling up memory, or not memories, but they're calling up this episode in history that happened more than four centuries ago.
Exactly. And they're not only calling it up, they are using it to glorify their own struggle and demonize their enemies. So I guess my view is actually sometimes it's better to remember. But I am saying that forgetting should be an option, and sometimes it's a better option.
And you're saying forgetting about particular atrocities that happened. Because, I mean, if there is this relentless quest to bring justice to things that happened maybe decades ago, that can just lead to more demand for retribution.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about remembrance, you're actually not talking about the past as it really was. You're talking about the past as the present chooses to reinterpret it. And we know historically that the past has been reinterpreted over and over again. There's no such thing as collective memory, after all. There's only individual memory. Memory's always a distortion of history. Memory's neither real memory, nor is it real history. It's a combination of myth and politics.
Well, I'm wondering if a better model in terms of how to handle past abuses, past atrocities, is something more along the lines of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, you know, once Nelson Mandela became president. I mean, so you're both investigating truth, but there's also a reconciliation component there. You're not just going to try to string up the people who had abused you.
But that's so interesting, that case. So, you know, if you go to a rally, many different kinds of sort of militant activist rallies, you'll hear no justice, no peace. Well, if you mean, as in fact they do mean, that you can't have peace without justice, well, that's false. That just isn't true. I can give you five examples of peace without justice. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa is a very interesting example of that, which is, by the way, why it was criticized by a lot of activists in South Africa. Because you could go, if you were a member of the former apartheid regime and you'd committed various crimes, you could go and testify, tell the truth, that is, give a kind of consolation to the victims, and also set the historical record straight. And this included assassins and people who put bombs in schools and all kinds of really vile people. But if you told the truth, you were in effect pardoned immediately. You know, you could testify in the afternoon and quite literally be home in time for supper with no further consequences to you. Now, that's peace, that's truth, but that's not justice, which already suggests that actually these things don't necessarily go together. In fact, they can even contradict each other.
So do you think that was the right thing for South Africa to do?
I do. But I'm always for peace, you see. I mean, if I have to choose between peace and justice, I'll take peace any day. Maybe that's what being a war correspondent for about 15 years of my one and only life taught me.
So you said there are other examples of countries or cultures that have chosen peace by forgetting. Tell me about one or two others.
Well, the Balkans is an obvious example. There's not going to be another war in the former Yugoslavia. It's a very unjust peace. In my view, the Bosnian government was the legitimate side, and to a very considerable extent, they lost. But there is a peace. People aren't being blown up every day. I mean, I think you can go around the world and in so many cases see peace deals that never gave people what they wanted. I think part of the illusion here is that we have in our heads the model in which we fight the bad guys and then they surrender unconditionally, sort of on the model of World War I and World War II. Once the Germans had surrendered, we could impose basically whatever memories we wanted through school books, through appointing leaders during the occupation of Germany. But most wars don't end that way. Most wars either end in slaughter of one side or in a negotiated peace in which nobody gets what they want. I mean, the deal in Northern Ireland didn't join Northern Ireland to the Republic of Ireland, which is what the Republicans wanted. And it certainly gave the Republicans more power, which was not what the Unionists, the Loyalists, wanted. But it was a kind of deal. And I'm afraid we're going to have to get used to that. I think this notion that remembering is always going to lead to a better result just doesn't take into account the realities of war and peace as they exist in our world and have existed in the past and are likely to exist in the future.
That's David Reif talking with Steve Paulson about his book, In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies. And coming up, the science of forgetting and the ancient cult of the memory palace. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from Organic Valley, a co-op of family farms bringing organic food to family tables. Founded in 1988, Organic Valley believes in producing food in a way that respects the earth, animals, and future generations. OrganicValley.com.
Suppose you could remember every single day of your life. Would that be amazing or terrible? For Jill Price, it's a burden. She's one of only a couple dozen people who've been diagnosed with hyperthymesia, which is a fancy word for nearly total recall. She's now in her early 50s, and she can remember every day of her life since the age of 14.
Let's see, 20 years ago today, I was in New York with my parents. My dad was an agent at William Morris, so we were here for the upfronts, and then we went to Florida for the weekend. And that weekend was the one-year anniversary that we had found out my mother had a brain tumor. So I was actually not fun to be around that time. I describe it like as if somebody's following me around with a video camera on my shoulder, and then each day is a tape on a shelf, and as soon as the day is mentioned, it's as if someone took the video and put it in a VCR, and I see the day. You know, everyone has points in their life where they're not, you know, proud of or happy, you know, bad decisions or bad experiences. And the thing is that, you know, people who have normal memories, that fades eventually, or it somehow fades, you know. I don't know how much because I don't have a normal memory, but I can't turn them off. You can't turn your brain off. I can't turn my brain off. I don't know about anyone else. But it's the good memories that get me through and comfort me and I guess have kept me sane. I remember when I was 17, I saw a woman in the bank who, she looked like Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies, and she was in her bathrobe, and she was screaming at the top of her lungs because she didn't know where she was. And the man that was standing next to me told the man standing next to him that she had Alzheimer's, and I had never heard of that before. And I've never forgotten her. And so when this all came about, she's somebody who I kept thinking of, and the kind of pain I saw in her face and fright. That, you know, I hope that with them studying me and that if other people come forward, they can study a whole group of us and hopefully find something that we have in our brains, or I have in my brain, that could help other people.
The That's Jill Price. And if you want to know more about her, look for her memoir, The Woman Who Can't Forget. So, in fact, neuroscientists are discovering a whole lot about how memory works. For instance, say I ask you to tell me what you heard in a previous segment, maybe the previous interview. So your mind is going to try to rewind the tape, but it's not going to just regurgitate the words. It's going to spool back the whole context, where you were sitting or standing, what you were doing or thinking or feeling when you heard that interview. And that insight turns out to be the key to helping people forget. At Dartmouth College, neuroscientist Jeremy Manning is figuring out how. He told Raymond Tunkekar he's had a lifelong fascination with how memory shapes who we are.
Ever since I was a young child, I've had this recurring thought, which is that your experiences up until this moment are just reflected in your memory. There's nothing else. So if I were to take my memory and implant them in someone else, or if I would take someone else's memory and implant them into my brain, from the perspective of myself, I would never be able to distinguish whether I was still the same person. So your memories kind of make you who you are.
Well, and I'm sure we'll get into some of that, but I mean, I got to ask a really basic question. What exactly is a memory?
Yeah, so a memory is when you reactivate a thought from your past. So when you remember a past event, you're getting a blend of your brain activity when you experience the event at first, plus your activity now.
Wow, okay. So you're kind of like rewriting a memory in a sense?
Well, then, you know, if you were to remember a past event multiple times, every time you remember that event, now you've got a blend not only of the original experience, but also of the last times you've remembered that experience. So memories can change over time, and it is all related to an idea called context. So if you think of eating dinner last night with some friends, some of your thoughts at that moment are going to be about the taste of the food, the sights, the sound, the smells, the textures that you're experiencing right at that moment. But your subjective experience is much richer than just plucking out an individual moment and experiencing it independently of everything else. So for example, as you're eating that dinner, maybe you're also mulling over a project from work, or maybe the fact that you're tired or that you had one too many glasses of wine. All those internally driven thoughts that don't come from your immediate experience provide a kind of context for your immediate experience. And it means that when you're remembering your dinner last night, the contextual thoughts you associated with that dinner are also going to come back.
Okay. So it sounds like you're saying the context, you know, for instance, like the smell in the air or the weather during your dinner yesterday, those details aren't just secondary to an actual memory. They have a more crucial role. They kind of help to anchor a memory in place. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's actually a great description. So if you experience the same event twice, like you have the same thing for dinner on multiple nights in your life, it's not the same experience because the context is going to be different.
Aren't you kind of like reassigning the contextual details to a specific memory every time you recall it?
You're definitely adding to the contextual details. So the idea is kind of interesting. It's that your thoughts about one specific moment are transient. So they fade in and out of existence with each new moment. But contextual thoughts persist in the brain for longer. In other words, the contextual thoughts you have in one moment hang around to influence the thoughts you have in the next moment.
Well, how does this relate to your work on the science of forgetting?
So I think of remembering and forgetting as really two sides of the same coin. So in my lab, I'm mostly interested in improving people's memory, but understanding how we remember also requires understanding when that process breaks down, like when we forget. And then just like remembering something can be beneficial, sometimes forgetting can be beneficial too. Post-traumatic stress disorder is kind of the classic example of this stuff. So say you're listening to a song on your iPod, and then you're like violently mugged while listening to that song. And then later the song comes on the radio, you know, maybe your traumatic memory is going to come rushing back to you. So one potential treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder involves sensitization. So you can have a patient gradually build up new safe associations with the innocuous stimulus, like the song you were listening to on your iPod or the street you were walking on or the store they had, you know, just come from. For example, you might have the patient re-experience those stimuli in new contexts or situations that they know are safe.
Well, I guess I'm not sure if this relates to your study, but reading about your study, it got me thinking about conventional approaches to dealing with trauma. It requires a little bit of backstory on my part. But basically, when I was a teenager, my mom passed away pretty suddenly. And it was probably like the most formative, important event in my life. And I remember in the months afterward, I mean, I did everything to just forget it and to distance myself from that. You know, I didn't talk about it. I didn't think about it. I tried to distract myself. And it's only recently did I realize that it was actually sitting with that grief, that pain, that, you know, allowed me to really grow and become a stronger, better person. And I guess it seems like there's a lot of emphasis placed on resilience and helping people move on and forget painful experiences. And I guess I'm wondering if that focus on resilience and bouncing back, if we're actually missing something kind of important.
Wow. Yeah. So you're saying maybe there's a value to not forgetting.
Exactly.
Yeah, I could see that. So our study does start to get at why things get easier with time, which comes back to this context idea. So the memory of your mother passing away probably came into your thoughts quite a bit. Well, every time you remembered that happening, you're not only re-experiencing the original memory, you're also experiencing, to some extent, those previous rememberings. That means that over time, your thoughts are kind of going to get smoothed out by more recent experiences. And so memories change and shift, you know, based on what's happening new in our lives.
That's our producer, Raymond Tungekar, talking with Dartmouth College neuroscientist Jeremy Manning. So now, from the science of forgetting to the art of remembering. Back before the internet, before encyclopedias, before card catalogs, having a good memory wasn't just a useful thing. It was prized as a sign of intelligence. And there were memory geniuses, people who had developed complex mental techniques for storing information. Techniques like memory palaces, where you construct room after imaginary room and you fill them with memories. So that's the jumping-off point for philosopher Simon Critchley's new novel, Memory Theater. He told Steve Paulson that the idea for the story came partly from his own life. As a young man, he had a terrible accident, which erased a big chunk of his memory.
I was working in a pharmaceutical factory when I was 18 years old. I was cleaning out a machine that was mixing drugs for diabetics. And the fact that it was a pharmaceutical factory becomes important because it was sterile conditions. And you had to lean over into this machine, which was like a huge kind of like washing machine with steel paddles churning. And to get the last of the residue out of the bottom of the mixer, you had to get your hand inside the machine. As I was cleaning the bottom of this thing out, somebody turned on the machine. My hand was caught in the machine. And I managed to kind of extract it, but the thing was basically sort of hanging off. I kept the hand, which was really good news. But the effect of it was a kind of erasure of memory, which appeared in the ensuing weeks. I just realized that there was all sorts of things that had just been kind of scrubbed away.
Why would you have lost some of your memory?
Sometimes, you know, traumatic accident like that can lead to a kind of memory wipe. Sometimes it comes back, sometimes it doesn't. In my case, it was a series of loss of childhood memory. And then you've got this sort of, you know, peculiar kind of epistemological problem of you don't know, you know, much, and then you're told things by your family about who you are and, you know, what you did in the past. And you look at photographs and you think, well, that must have been me. And then you construct that memory as a memory that's yours, but you don't really remember it. You're not quite sure what it is that you know and you don't know.
So one of the big ideas of your book has to do with memory, and specifically the creation of what were called memory palaces, usually hundreds of years ago. And these were mental constructions where people would essentially place memories of all kinds of things, and they could be very elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, I mean, there's an ancient Greek poet, a very, very famous and very rich Greek poet called Simonides. And there was a rather nasty story connected with Simonides, which was that he was giving a recitation for a lot of money with some wealthy people. And he stepped out of the building. The building collapsed and killed all the wealthy people inside. But he remembered where all the people were, so badly injured by the fall of the house on these people that they were unrecognizable. But Simonides was able to remember who was sitting where. And this began the idea that there was an association between memory and location and place. And that's the key of the idea of a memory palace, or in the book I talk about a memory theatre, the idea that memory is a location or a series of locations. And to have a trained memory is to basically be able to wander around inside your head and visit certain places where certain things are stored. And, you know, it raises this really interesting question that for most of human history, most of what was thought of as education was to have a rhetorically trained memory.
Right. I mean, the sign of intelligence was to have mm-hmm. a great memory, right, for centuries.
And to be able to then produce that great memory in speech in order to persuade people of certain things or to recite things or whatever. And then there was a tradition which is in antiquity, but it really takes off in the Renaissance in Italy, where people actually constructed theatres, buildings that would house their memories. And
when you say construct, just construct in an imaginary way or actually physically construct?
Actually physically construct. I mean, there's evidence of maquettes being built and possibly more than that, so that a building, in this case a theatre, each of the seats in the theatre would be occupied by, let's say, a statue or a striking figure, or, I don't know, the main characters in Homer's Iliad or whatever it might be. As you would survey your theatre, you would survey the entirety of what could be known and what you knew, and you'd be able to kind of enter and then recall everything.
Yeah. Well, there's a real historical figure who comes up prominently in your book, this Italian guy named Giulio Camillo. Tell me about him.
Well, he was he constructed memory theatres in Venice in the late 15th century, and the idea this is a twist to the whole idea of the memory theatre. You could build a memory theatre that would house the entire sum of what could be known, and at the point of surveying the entirety of what could be known, at that point you would have absolute knowledge. You would have knowledge of the entirety of the sum of the universe.
You would basically be godlike at that point.
Exactly. At that point, the difference between you and God would disappear. Your intellect would have become divine. So you can see that was quite an attractive prospect for people. And so what you find in these memory theatres, memory palaces, are all sorts of kind of occult and hermetic interests.
Now, as you've already mentioned, there is an obvious modern analogy here. You know, these memory theaters would seem to be what Google is trying to do right now, to create
exactly.
a digital copy of everything that's ever been written so that it's accessible to everyone. I mean, in theory, at least, we could have the entire knowledge of the world at our fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Except we don't trust it anymore. We don't trust ourselves anymore. The strange thing is, and our difference with what's gone on in the past, is that memory was an internal activity. It was something you looked inward, you inspected your memory. It was something you had to recall internally. Whereas now we've gone to a model of kind of technologized memory, a kind of external memory. Everything is out there. Everything is potentially knowable in an objective archival form on the internet. And our heads are kind of empty.
And there's no particular currency to or value to having a good memory now. I mean, yes, if you're in high school and you got to memorize a lot of stuff for a test. But other than that, I mean, you can get through life pretty well with having a lousy memory.
Yeah, and I think whether that's a good or a bad thing, in a sense, I'm not sure. I think it's a bad thing. But it makes us very different from most human creatures that have existed before, and most kind of forms of social organization, where memory was highly treasured and highly prized and highly cultivated. Its veracity, all these memories true, in a sense, you know, it's neither here nor there. It's just these are the stories, so that a great poet, let's imagine a great bardic poet like Homer, would have been able to summon from memory the stories of the Trojan War. Would they have been empirically accurate? Well, it turns out, you know, actually a lot of it was, but the rest were kind of, there were stories, things that were told and passed on in an approximative form. And we, you know, we risk losing access to that. And that worries me. Once you've memorized something, it's yours, you possess it. I think there's a kind of power to that, which is formidable. Those things that I remember were mine, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, one final question. What happens to a society that loses its memories?
I think it ceases to be a society. I think it's in a very, very perilous state. And I think the strength of the social bond could be linked directly to the strength of memory, not as something, you know, that's stored on a series of hard drives or machines somewhere, you know, out in the desert, but something which is in people's heads and which connects them together. And of course, that can be illusory. You know, people can think all sorts of strange ideas about who they are as a people, but without a memory, I think a society just ceases to be a society. It becomes a kind of random amalgamation of individuals with no particular purpose.
Simon Critchley is a philosopher at the New School for Social Research. He and Steve were talking about his novel, Memory Theater. Coming up next, filmmaker Whit Stillman brings a little-known Jane Austen novel to the screen. Although the funny thing is, the first time he read Austen, he didn't like her.
I had a sort of bad first experience. I read Northanger Abbey when I was 18. I was a depressed sophomore in college, and I hated it. And I told everyone how horrible Jane Austen was, overrated. I couldn't understand why anyone liked her, blah, 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 the usual.
Luckily for Jane Austen fans, he changed his mind. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. When Jane Austen was just 19 years old, she wrote the first draft of a novel called Lady Susan. It's the story of a beautiful and unprincipled widow and her scheme to marry her innocent daughter off for money. Now, Austen never finished the novel, but now film director Whit Stillman has, in a new film and a novel of his own, both called Love and Friendship. This is a bit of a departure. Stillman is best known for a trio of films he made in the 1990s, Metropolitan, Barcelona, and The Last Days of Disco. They were ironic, talky movies about rich, urban, overeducated preppies. So he's not the kind of director you would expect to do a costume drama love story. But Lady Susan seduced him, along with everyone else.
Catherine, letter. Seems Lady Susan will finally visit. In fact, she's already on her way.
What?
Lady Susan Vernon. Congratulations on being about to receive the most accomplished flirt in all England.
Whit, you've been a Jane Austen fan for a long time. So tell us about Lady Susan. Now, this was an unfinished novel that you drew on for the film. I've heard you describe it as a little evil. How come?
Well, the novella is not evil, but the protagonist is fairly evil, and her best friend, Alicia Johnson, is fairly evil. Their aspirations are to marry for money, and they're sort of waiting for people to die, so there might be money available for them. And Jane Austen's humorous. I mean, she's a wonderful sense of humor in all her writings. But this was a different kind of humor. it's more what we associate with Oscar Wilde or something like that.
You promised that you would give up all contact with this woman.
What a mistake you made marrying him. Too old to be governable, too young to die.
Lady Susan.
How dare you address me, sir? Be gone, I will have you whipped.
Outrageous. Have you never met him?
No, I know him well. I would never speak to a stranger like that.
There are so many really great single lines in this.
Yes.
I hadn't thought of Austin as so much of a, I don't know, it's like 18th century one-liners.
Yeah, there are loads of them. And my favorite is facts are hard things. Facts are hard things.
Some of my favorite bits involve this guy, Sir James Martin.
Yes.
This is the guy Lady Susan is scheming to have marry her daughter.
How jolly. Tiny green balls. Yes.
Well, I'd say he's good very tasting. Silly. He's a bit of a rattle.
Quite
he's
sweet.
No Solomon.
What are they called?
Peas.
If my daughter were not the greatest simpleton on earth, she'd be engaged to him now.
It's funny because Austin's novels are generally considered romances. I mean, I first fell in love with them as, you know, a 16-year-old girl reading, going back and forth between Pride and Prejudice and, I don't know, Harlequin romances.
Yes. And that's the way they're sort of, the adaptations are marketed. But I don't think that's what she's doing, really. So, yes, there's that pleasure that you have because it's a story of people finding each other and falling in love and getting married. But the meat of what she's doing is not really that. She's observing and appreciating character and expressing character. And there's a lot of sense along with the sensibility.
So were you wanting to create a different kind of Austin film? I mean, sort of
yes.
bring out that
yes.
element of her in a way that we haven't seen in some other Austin adaptations?
Exactly. I mean, why does one make films? One makes films because one doesn't like everyone else's films. So among the Austin adaptations, the one I really admire is the Emma Thompson, Ang Lee, Sense and Sensibility. And I felt that maybe with our film Love and Friendship, we could be sort of the comic counterpoint to that. So if people wanted to sort of see their first, you know, Jane Austen adaptations, they could see that for the romance and ours for the comedy.
I'm afraid Sir James's best qualities are not immediately apparent.
And yours is like this sharp-edged comedy of manners.
How many suitors of great wisdom could a young woman expect to find these days?
Don't know.
None. And I confess, I ask myself, is such a quality even desirable in a husband?
I don't know. Stephen Fry, who's in our film, gave a disquisition on Jane Austen. And I think the word manners has been rendered useless now. It's too much associated with forks and napkins and Emily Post. And so we shouldn't use comedy of manners. We should go back to comedy of morals. You know, this is serious stuff. It's not sort of frivolous society, I don't know what.
But, I mean, what are the moral ideas that she's or you are playing with or raising in Love and Friendship?
That's over my head. I can't say. I don't know. It's in there somewhere. Someone's going to figure it out. That's why I read critics, because I want to know the critics' thinking as well as what the author said.
Hmm. What you said in other interviews, that you love the 18th century, that you just feel completely comfortable in it. How come?
Well, I don't feel comfortable in it because I think it was quite uncomfortable. But I do love it and I admire it. And I think the comfort factor might have been bad.
What do you love about it or admire about it?
The architecture, the music, the literature, the clothes, the houses, the dances, horses and carriages sound great.
But aside from that, I mean,
the movies weren't very good back then.
Yeah, that too. But I mean, do you think you would have preferred to live then?
No, I don't think that. Because I don't think the differences between the 18th century and the present are necessarily that vast. I mean, I think we sort of exaggerate differences between decades and between years.
In what way do you think the 18th century is similar to our century?
Well, in what ways is it different? That's a better question.
Okay, bathrooms, central heating, way of life, the internet.
Yeah, I don't think those things are really very important. I mean, how we distract ourselves, you know, I don't know. I think we exaggerate the differences sometimes.
It's interesting. We were thinking about the 18th century and the Enlightenment culture. It was a very critical, very science-inspired culture, you know, just reason we call it the Age of Reason. And I think there's a kind of particular ironic sensibility also, which I know that critics have pointed out in your films, but I think there's also a really strong thread of romanticism running at least through this film. When we were talking about, you know, the beautiful rooms and the gardens and the houses and the gorgeous clothes and the music. So I guess what I'm working around to ask is I'm wondering if you think of yourself as more of a classic Enlightenment rationalist or more of a romantic.
Well, I find romanticism appealing but dangerous. So if, for instance, someone was to read a lot of F. Scott Fitzgerald and become very sort of obsessed with the F. Scott Fitzgerald view of the world, I think you'd be a little bit deranged. You're a little bit inequipped to deal with daily life. And one of the good things about Jane Austen is she doesn't have that. She's not a romantic that way. And reading Jane Austen and appreciating her thought makes one better equipped to deal with things and be sane and not be crazy and depressed and hysterical that some other books can lead you to. So I love Balzac, but I feel really evil when I read Balzac. I feel he's leading me to think evil thoughts, and the Catholic Church banned his books, and I think they were right to from their point of view. He really makes one want to, you know, meet the wealthy woman and marry her so one can have her fortune. And that's the way he's thinking all the time, or having his characters think. So each writer sort of brings a certain sanity or lack of sanity to the way we regard the world.
And as a filmmaker, do you feel like you've satisfied your longing for the 18th century, or did this just whet your appetite?
I do have another project that I would do if I had time to do it, so I've sort of thought that through and have it, but I just don't know if I can get everything done.
Okay, you're going to leave us with a mystery then.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, thanks for talking today.
Thanks very much.
Whit Stillman is the director of the film Love and Friendship. He's also written his own novel with the same title, both based on the original by Jane Austen. That's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher, or visit our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.